brought to you by Satanic International Network. You're listening to The Ooze.
Upon the stage, every foul wicked spirit in the host, The Ooze.
20 minutes, Daniel Rouve, on The Ooze, spread out.
On The Ooze, it's gonna fucking rock. Be there.
The whole point.
To really tap into have a serial crime
necessitates a certain fortitude.
Now onto our show.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm TC Downey, and with me on the air is Jason King. Jason, how you doing, man?
Oh, great, man. It's awesome. It's all good, man.
Right on. So, what the hell was it? I'm barely awake, dude. I rolled out of bed like an hour ago.
You're killing me, you know, because I wanted to confront you about something silly, you know, really silly off the top, is that you did edit that intro. I know you did, because there was a part in there where I was talking about you got four big dicks in the room, and that was somehow killed off the intro.
No, it's still, that was in the other intro.
Oh, the other one, the one before it got edited, right?
No.
But seriously, we can get to topic. I'm just fucking around. I don't care because, you know, whatever.
No, what happened was, this is actually intro version number 5. I've done 5 different intros, all of them having different background music, all of them having different voices mixed into them or whatever. And this was the final one, and it kind of all came off of this idea of, there's a little section in there, if you listen to it, where you say you kind of missed the whole point.
No, I heard that part. I heard me there. I was just saying, no, it's all good. I thought it got, you would have been better served by just saying, well, hey, look, Blog Talk Radio contacted me and said you can't say the word dicks in a promo or something like that. And I'd have been like, oh, yeah, all right, cool. But no, I'm just kidding. I'm fucking busting your balls. Right off the chops on some stupid shit. But I'm just fucking around.
No, it's all good, man. But
you said you need to be woken up, right?
Yeah, I'm barely awake, dude. I have one cup of coffee. Actually, we're completely out of coffee otherwise in the house right now. But that's all right. I'll get through this hour and go get me some coffee, and we'll be all right. So today we're kind of talking about the origin of Christianity. This was all pretty much inspired off of me watching a National Geographic special on the Gospel of Judas, and then going to look up the actual Gospel of Judas to see what the hell it really said. And then from there, it kind of sprang into my mind, oh, well, wait a minute, you know, that there are these other books that nobody really ever talks about much, And, I mean, it's really fascinating how this all kind of came down anyways, because, I mean, moving into the first century, there was not a unified Christianity like there is now. It was very different teachings from very different schools, so it's kind of
neat. Well, exactly. I mean, it's not even that, you know, there's a unified Christianity now, but all of the schools that we have now are pretty much owed to one school. That would have been the dominant school, the one that came out ahead within those first couple centuries, which we call today Roman Catholicism or, you know, Eastern Orthodoxy, depending on your slant on that. But those two are so, you know, indifferent. I mean, not indifferent, but they're so slightly different that it doesn't really matter. I mean, they really only disagree on one point of theology and also one point of something else, which is more politics. But really, yeah, everything that we have today in Christianity comes from that. So Martin Luther, John Calvin, all these other people, the reformers, and then even when you start getting into the silly shit, like even Mormons and fucking Jehovah's Witnesses and all those people, they all owe their existence to that whole argument that was had in those first 2.5 centuries. So, yeah, exactly. I mean, early Christianity to me is an awesome field of study because, you know, it's not only a study of you know, sociology and of myth making and religion making, but it's also a study of things that are bigger than that in a way, because these are paradigm shifting things that were shifted. The paradigms were shifted that early on, and you know, it's awesome. So go ahead, man.
Right on, man. Well, the first point that I kind of wanted to make was, according to this video, and then according to the light research that I've been able to do since seeing this video, this character, Irenaeus, as you corrected me, just before the show started, wrote a book which was called Against Heresies, or Adversius Heresius. This book was an attack on the then Gnostic schools of Christianity that were out there, and his premise was pretty much that Jesus and all the apostles, they weren't Gnostic. They were bishops of sorts, and you know, this is why only the bishops could give you the truth about Jesus and teach his message. So what's fascinating to me is that out of the 30, I think it was 30 actual Gospels that were available at that point in time, he only picked four. And he picked four to match the four elements in the four corners of the world. So to him, this was the only way that you could set the structure correctly for this, what would be now known as you know, Christianity, or the Bible, as so to speak. So, I don't know if you know anything extra about this dude, but I think it's kind of interesting the way that he argued some of these things based on the fact that, you know, since there are four elements, there should only be four Gospels, even though there were 30 written at the time.
You know what's funny to me is that, yes, Irenaeus is completely pivotal when it comes to what's normally called Catholic doctrine. There are several others that are as well, including two people that have never been given saint status, meaning that Irenaeus of Lyons, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, that's right.
Was given sainthood, but there were two others that were even more pivotal in determining not only orthodoxy but the canon that were never and will never, and those are Tertullian and Origen. And because both of these people were slightly heretical, Origen actually, they had a nickname for him. He was called Brassballs back in the day. Because what he did was he took Jesus' statement to the effect that, you know, if you want to get in the kingdom of heaven, you have to, if, you know, the eye offends thee, cut it off. And, well, what irritated him or what stopped him from getting in the kingdom of heaven? Well, obviously he liked to fuck, so he smashed his own balls, or he tied them off, and he castrated himself. So, I mean, you know, the early story of Christianity is really awesome when you really get into it, and it's not as orthodox as people would like you to believe in the, you know, Monday morning quarterback chair, what have you, to think about it after the fact. No, it was really, there was a lot of things going on. If we wanted to get into, you know, older shit to me is Paul, because Paul was the most prior thinker within Christianity as far as it dating goes, as far as the documents that we have from that individual. Now, was Paul dependent on something else? Of course he was. So, and then these other gospels. But yeah, if you read through the early church fathers, you'll read some really silly arguments, especially when they're arguing against pagans. You know what I mean? There was who wrote something contra Celsus? I forget who the fuck is. Celsus, C-E-L. C-U-S, somebody wrote something against that dude. Might have been even Origen, I forget, that wrote that kind of a document. But you'll find that these early Christians used a lot of arguments that were really silly from our point of view, but that made a lot of sense to them. So, like, yeah, there's got to be four Gospels because there's four elements and stuff like that. Well, they're Greeks. That's how they're thinking. They're Greeks. You know what I mean? Or even Irenaeus was a Roman, but or in the, you know, in that tradition, but he was still had that Greek mentality in him, so he had to think that way. Or there's four corners of the world, of course, because, well, that's where he came from. So, you know, it's only in the hindsight of history, but then they had so much more source material available to them. They had so much more in the way of, like, we only have the Gospel of Peter in fragments. And then we can look at, like, for example, Eusebius, who, you know, that's the guy I thought you meant when we were talking earlier, that really canonized Scripture. Eusebius's canon is generally regarded as the one that kind of turned things, but you got me when you said the C thing. But the thing is, though, that Eusebius quotes a lot of shit, but he quotes it just like almost as a teaser to us in the 20th century, because we don't have these documents. They're lost to us. I mean, a lot of them we found again, you know, just through, like, digging shit up. Like, for example, the Nag Hammadi Library, or even the Dead Sea Scrolls. These were things that we had to, you know, basically dig up again. Even the Gospel of Judas, which is obviously you saw it on the National Geographic Channel, because that's their pet project. That's something that they actually had stake in, meaning money stake in, that they actually got that done. So, yeah, they were in charge of that whole excavation, but it was still an excavation. We still had to dig that shit up. We had little bits and quotes of that document from these church fathers just critiquing it, but we never had the whole document. We still don't, but we have a bigger part of it now, and we can then go back and look at how they were critiquing it and what they were, and see all the vectors that were going on. So yeah, it's really cool.
Right,
it's like a mystery.
I would agree with that. What's really interesting to me, something that I was not aware of until you actually until you brought it up in conversation the other day, and that's that the thing called the Q. I think that's quite fascinating, because in a way that's really the only way that you might get to, you know, some unified teaching of Jesus is through this same method that they're using. It obviously wasn't what the forefathers of Christianity had in mind as they were coming along. They wanted to make sure that everything stayed directly under the church or in their thumb.
Well, actually, I'm going to agree a little bit and disagree a little bit. A Q is a document that is given to explain the similarities between Matthew and Luke while understanding that they're both dependent on Mark. So, for example, Matthew and Luke have a lot in common, but none of those commonalities agree with Mark, and they're mostly sayings. So this document, the Q document, is essentially a sayings document like Thomas, like the Gospel of Thomas, that would account for those similarities. So, like, they both had this, in other words, or they were both sourced by this. That's why it's called the Q source or the Q document, whatever. It's a hypothetical document. Nobody's ever unearthed it, what have you. And there are, you know, chains in scholarship that actually critique the existence of this and say that, you know, you could, for example, argue for what's called Matthean primacy, which would be that the Gospel of Matthew is prior, in which case you don't need a Q. But then there's other problems. And those problems are even more severe. So it's like most scholars take Markan primacy. That means Mark is the first gospel that we have. And then Q was roughly contemporaneous with that, meaning that Q existed. We give it a letter because we don't really have the document. We don't know how it was vector or anything. It was a sayings gospel like Thomas. And then say that Matthew and Luke both had Mark and Q and borrowed from each and vectored each as they saw fit. And that's the, you know, that's the theory that makes the most sense, and that's the theory that most scholars admit to and say that's pretty much probably the way it worked. You know what I mean?
Right on. Well, what I was kind of getting at was the only way that we could really get to any true understanding of what Jesus taught was by a comparison made like that, not necessarily just those specific three gospels, but had they spread it out through all of these Gospels. And I mean, you made the point to me the other day that the Gospel of Thomas is actually probably one of the earliest of them. And
it is. Among modern scholars, they mostly admit that Thomas probably predates, it definitely predates John. And it probably is at least contemporaneous with Matthew and Luke. Now, the question is, how did things come about the way they came about? You know what I mean? Insofar as, like you said, there's only four Gospels. There's a famous apologist, I forget, in the second century that says, you know, we have four gospels, the heretics have many. And there is a case to be made, I think, for a lot of late dating, for a lot of what might be called even Judas or Philip or a lot of these other weird gospels where, you know, you can see elements in them that obviously speak to a later dating. But these same arguments that those scholars make towards those documents are also made towards the canonical gospels or the gospels that are in the Bible. For example, a lot of, you know, Christians or hardcore Christians want to say that, you know, certain gospels were written before the fall of the temple. That would be 70 AD. And obviously they're not. And the same arguments are made in both cases, meaning that if an event happens and something, quote unquote, prophesies it or says it's going to happen, that doesn't mean that it was a genuine prophecy. In most cases, what it means is it's a Monday morning quarterback, meaning that that happened, and then they wrote about this later on and tried to reinterpret it and then put words into somebody's mouth to say that, yeah, this was going to happen eventually. But, you know, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes pretty good sense.
There's a book out there. It's called The Five Gospels. It's written by, actually, it's the Jesus Seminar, I believe, that did this, the whole thing. Let me pull it out. Robert Funk, Roy Hoover, and the Jesus Seminar. And what it is it's the five Gospels, not the four that we have in the Bible. And obviously the fifth is Thomas. And what they do with that is they go through the Jesus Seminar was like, you know, 80 scholars or something like that. And they're all PhDs in the field, meaning that they're all like theological PhDs, whatever you want to call them. And they're all the most forefront scholars when it comes to, like, New Testament. They all read Greek. They all read the Koine Greek or whatever the fuck the New Testament was written in. And they all have a background in this whole thing. And they go through those five documents, and they vote. And, some New Testaments or some Bibles, they'll have the words of Jesus in red. What they do is they play on that, and they say, okay, well, the ones that we really think, like, it has to be like a 75% or greater percent agree Jesus actually said, that's going to be red. If maybe 60% or less think that it's, you know, what Jesus said, then it's pink. If maybe, you know, 40% or less think that it's what Jesus said, then it's gray. And if 25% or less think that that's what Jesus said, then it's in black. So what it is, it's like an annotated fucking New Testament, or annotated Gospels, actually, the five Gospels. And it's awesome. I mean, just because it's not just that, but for each one, they give the arguments. They give the arguments of why. Why was this something Jesus said, or why wasn't it something he said? And if you look through it, what you'll see is that you'll see that the Gospel of John has nothing in red, or maybe one, I think, maybe one verse is in red of John's gospel. But Thomas has a lot in red. And what these scholars have come to understand is that when you're really trying to get back to the origin of Christianity, that, you know, there's a lot of things in common within a few source documents that have to be taken very, very seriously if we're going to be under the impression that we can understand anything about the origin of Christianity. Otherwise, you know, for example, the Gospel of Judas wins out, which you can see that in a certain light, not see that the truth of that, but you can see where the Gospel of Judas came from in a certain light. It's more akin to the Gospel of Philip and the Apocryphon of John, etc. It's a Gnostic document. They're flipping on a verse, I think it was, hold on a second, actually, well, I flipped this open, but what the hell, okay. It's Mark 4, I think, what is it, 20, where the hell is it, Mark 4, 34, but without a parable he did not speak to them, and when they were alone, he explained all things to his disciples. That one verse, and Mark, remember, is the earliest gospel, coined a lot of a lot of apocryphal New Testament literature, in the sense that everybody wanted to be able to come out with that piece that was told to this apostle that was never told to that other apostle, if that makes any sense. So it's like they're one-upping each other at this point, and they're mostly working within the Gnostic schools because they're trying to combat this growing orthodoxy, which they don't like.
Right on.
Which none of us like. You know what I mean? Because I don't think even they got it right. You know what I mean? The orthodoxy is based primarily, I think, around Paul. And I think that real Jesus, the historical Jesus, had pretty much nothing to do with what eventually became Christianity. But that's the ultimate origin of Christianity, which goes even deeper. So it's like, how deep does the rabbit hole go? I don't know.
Right.
But anyway, go ahead, man. I've cut you off long enough, dude.
it's all good, man. You're much more knowledgeable about this kind of thing than me, so it's good to see the information getting out there. One of the things that I kind of wanted to point to is a certain text referred to as Marcionian's Gospel of Luke.
Martian. It's pronounced Martian, but it's spelled, you're right, M-A-R-C-I-O-N.
Right.
But it's pronounced Martian. I know that sounds like a Martian from outer space, but that's just how it's pronounced. No, I'm go ahead, man.
Oh, but this dude, he had his own version of Luke, in which I guess he wrote, stating that it was more of a genuine text, and that Arrhenius, the guy that we were talking about earlier, had forged, in fact, the three, Matthew, Mark, and John, that would have been prior to it. So it's just interesting to me that this guy has this completely different text. It's, I don't know, it's not real Jewish in nature, but it's supposedly, from what he's stating, is more genuine as an original document than what would later surface. And I'm not really certain as to, why this tradition wasn't kept along within things, other than, again, like I was saying in the beginning, they needed to wrap everything up so it made one nice little package that gave all the power to the church, so...
Well, that's really the bottom line, to be honest with you. Martianite beliefs, and Martian himself, actually, I know when I keep saying that, but that's the way it's really pronounced. I'm sorry to be sounding like I'm talking about Martians and shit. No, but he was probably the greatest of the heretics. When it comes to the early church, I mean, it was Valentinius and some other things, but he was the guy. What he did was he actually blended Persian beliefs as well into his own system. And so, of course, he can be seen favoring Luke's gospel. Obviously, why? Because Luke's gospel is the most Gentile of the gospels, meaning that it's the most open to some kind of a Gentile interpretation, meaning like it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with Judaism. It does, but at the same time, it's the most easily distanced, if you will, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
There was a time, I mean, like I said, I wanted to prepare better for this. I forget whether or not Martian, I believe that he really had a very high liking of Paul, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm double checking it for you right now, so just give me a minute here. But
no, it's all good, man. I thought that he was like the, he was called Paul's apostle. I thought it in some work that I read, but a lot of what I've
that's correct. From what Wikipedia says, and I'm just on this page right now, Martian affirmed Jesus to be the Savior sent by the Heavenly Father and Paul as his chief apostle. So I'm assuming that that's absolutely correct. He was, in fact, Paul's boy. So.
Well, Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead. Don't cut each other off with the go-aheads, man.
Right,
no,
on.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding, man. Somebody needs to call in. Like if Tim is hardcore would call in, that would be awesome because he's the one Christian I actually have any fucking respect for. So that would be awesome. I mean, we're talking the origins of Christianity. I realize it's probably early for him, but, you know, whatever, man.
Yeah, we're all alone today, man. There's nobody sitting in the chat room. It's just you and me. I find this thing interesting in that there's actually, I guess, four different types of gospels? Let me look at this shit again. There's the synoptic gospels.
You're going that route, that different route. Go ahead.
Yeah, the canonical, and I'm trying to think of, yeah, I guess it's only those two different types, so I was wrong there. For some reason, I thought there were four different kinds, but...
Oh, no, there are as many as you want to say there are. I mean, like what you said, synoptic is basically Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and the reason they're called synoptic is because it's with one eye. They see together, meaning that a lot of the text is repeated, and that's what's called the synoptic problem. That's why... We came up with Q to begin with, or I didn't come up with it, but certain scholars did to explain why Matthew and Mark agreed as much as they did, but also agreed with Mark. That meant they obviously had another source. They had Mark as a source, and then they had this other thing as a source, which was the Sayings Gospel. That now that we have Thomas, we understand that Q is most probably a real document, even though we don't have it, simply because Thomas also had Q as a source. And you can see the way that each of these authors, meaning Matthew, Luke, and Thomas, vector the Q document sayings, which Q would have been a sayings gospel, just like Thomas. Meaning it wasn't a story gospel like the rest of them. The ones that made it into the New Testament were all story gospels, meaning it was like a story. Like Jesus went here, he did this. He said this, then he went here, then he said this, then he did this. A sayings gospel was just basically like dude speaking, you know what I mean? Which is more kind of like if you look at Judas, was a dialogue gospel. That was like a sayings gospel, but it was a dialogue gospel, meaning that it was Jesus speaking and then Judas and then Jesus and then Judas. But it was also a story gospel in the sense that there were other little things thrown in there. So... You can't really, I mean, it just depends on what your categories are as to how you decide what gospel is what. Canonical just means that it made it into the New Testament. So a canonical gospel is just one of the four that made it in. I mean, right. That's really all that is. So, but I've heard it, you know, said that there are different types of gospels generally. What I would say is that there are what are called saying gospels, which would be like Q. Thomas would be an example of that. And then there are what might be called, what's the word I'm looking for here? What I would say is a story gospel, but there's another word for it, and it's just losing me now, and I don't want to waste too much time trying to fucking think about it or look it up, where you have like the story of Jesus, et cetera. That's another kind of gospel. And then you also have these highbrow gospels, like the Gospel of Truth, for example, that are more concerned with, they're more philosophical, but they call themselves gospels. But they're not really gospels in the truest sense of, you know, well, what is a gospel? A gospel is a good news, you know what I mean? And that gets back to, again, the origins of Christianity, which is, you know, what is the good news? What is, obviously, everybody kind of agrees on that term, the good news, the gospel. Paul agreed on it. Everybody pretty much agreed on it. But what is the good news? And I think that they disagreed on what that good news was.
Yeah, I got to give it to you there. I mean, just looking at the difference between, say, the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Judas and what's traditional canon now, I mean, there's a huge riff in what the good news actually is. I mean, in the Gospel of Thomas, it almost, you know, he's almost, well, he does say, you know, that Jesus said that heaven was in you. I think it's the third verse, actually, that he says something like, you know, if the kingdom is in heaven, then the birds will be in heaven before you. If it's in the sea, then the fish before you. But the kingdom is within you, and it's outside of you. And when you know yourself, then you shall be known, and you shall know that you are the son of a living father.
Thomas is one of the most interesting documents that historians have been able to study because of that. Just because of things like that. I'm going to do a favor. What I use, by the way, is a when I'm doing I have about a billion Bibles, by the way. But when I'm doing a study like this, I go with it's called the Complete Gospels. It's published by the same dudes that did the Five Gospels, meaning the Jesus Seminar. They use that same shitty-ass translation, which is the Scholar's Translation. And I hate that translation, to be honest with you. But still, it has the best sources in a lot of different places. So I'm just flipping it open randomly, and I'm going to read verse 39. Jesus says, "The Pharisees and the scholars have taken the keys of knowledge. They themselves have hidden them. Neither have they entered, nor have they allowed those who want to enter to do so. As for you, be as sly as snakes and as simple as doves." And, of course, that has parallels in the canonicals as well. And that was 39, saying 39. So, whatever, you know.
Right on, man. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting stuff. I mean, like, what piqued my interest about this Gospel of Judas thing was, if I was reading it correctly, which I'm, like, scrolling through it right now to actually find where he talks about it. But what he actually says is that, here we go, why has the adjective, your God who is within you, which this I thought was interesting. No, that's not it. That's not what I was looking for. But what he's basically saying is that the God that the Jews worship is not the God that he's worshiping right now. That's not his God. The God of the Jews is a worldly God, a cruel God, and his God is a higher God. And I'm trying to find exactly where that's at and there to read that to you. But I thought that was really fascinating, because if that was a point that was true, then if he really said that, then they would have all the reason in the world to want to fucking have him nailed up to that wooden stick.
No, actually, I think he was nailed to that stick for a whole different reason. I do believe that Judas is what's called spurious, meaning that it's not real at all. What it's dealing with is later interpretations of the vector that was Jesus. You got to understand, the biggest problem for Christians from the early days, from the very beginning, was the fact that he got killed. That was a big problem for them. They had a hard time dealing with that, and they did their best. And even you look at the Orthodox apologists and the way they came back with it, and they went through the Old Testament, and they just sifted it out, and they came up with everything in Isaiah, and they came up with everything in Jeremiah, or wherever the fuck they had to come up with it, to figure out why the Son of Man had to die. Or had to suffer, and they did. They did their best, and they came up with like about 5 proof texts for apologetics, and that's what they had. And so, but you know, there was equal number of proof texts that could say that, for example, the Messiah would not die, that he would reign. I mean, so, but this document, meaning Judas, is just. I mean, it takes. From several other documents and stuff like that, but at the same time, I just cannot see that it offers anything towards the beginning.
Yeah, I would certainly agree that it doesn't offer anything towards the beginning. I just think it's fascinating that some of the stuff that's said in there is extremely esoteric in nature, you know, of course, we only have 85% of that text preserved anyway. But it's just really wild stuff, because if you look at the what's in there, you know, he kind of lines out there being, I guess, I'm trying to think of how to explain this. There are five who ruled over the underworld, and he gives Seth, who is called the Christ. He gives Harmathoth, if I'm saying that right.
The first is Seth, who is called Christ. The second is Harmathoth, who is, and then that's obviously a lacuna in the text. The third is Galilea, I guess. I'm not entirely sure. The fourth is Yobel. The fifth is Adonias, which that's obviously Adonai, which would be the way that, well, that's a whole separate thing, which I could explain, but I don't want to kill time, so... It would be God. It would be the Lord. Whenever you see the word Lord, that's Adonai.
Right, right. I know that. And that was kind of actually what I was getting at, was that he's kind of making the suggestion of an inversion, from what we traditionally understand. You know.
But he's not alone, is what I'm saying. This was a school of Gnostic thought. They had this idea from the beginning. Or from the beginning of Gnosticism, they had this idea that Jesus was sent from the highest God, and that, you know, well, he's called, depending on which system you're talking about, but Yaldabaoth. Even in the five books of Cain, I mentioned that dude.
Yeah.
He's a broken God. I mean, he's basically the father of the Old Testament. So when Jesus talks about Abba Father, he's not really talking about that guy. That's where the Gnostics and the Catholics, or I call them Catholic, Orthodox, whatever you want to fucking call them, the people that basically ended up codifying Christianity, had a big disagreement, was in that regard, was as to who did Jesus answer to? And was the God of the Old Testament a good God? Or was he a bad God? I mean, you know, you can make that argument either way. I mean, I've seen it argued very deftly on both sides. But go ahead, man.
Right on. Well, I'm just there's just so much to cover, man. I'm not even sure which way to kind of go on this. We've got about 20 minutes, and I'm looking at these things. I guess the first thing, I kind of promised we would go through, all the Gospels, or at least the ones that we know that we have, and at least name them, but there's 23 lost Gospels. Those would be like the Gospel of Bartholomew. Jason, yep, you're there.
Of course I'm here.
Yeah, the background sound just changed. It went absolutely quiet. So I was like, oh, wait.
Let me help you out. You got Mark, Matthew, Luke, John. I'm skipping over some things. Q, Thomas. Secret James, Dialogue of the Savior, Gospel of Mary, Emphasis Thomas, Emphasis James, Gospel of Peter, Secret Mark, Egerton, and then those are just the ones that are admitted by scholars. And then I could go into some other things. Hold on a second. Actually, didn't have that fucking page open. Gospel of Truth, the Gospel of Philip. Depends on what you mean by gospel, though, and this is where it really gets into be a problem. The Gospel of Mary, I think I already did that one, right?
Right.
Gospel of, John, there he is again. Yeah, I'm flipping back and forth between several different books here. Did I say I did Truth already, right?
Yeah, you did Truth. What do you think is the difference between, like, the Gospel of Four Heavenly Realms and the Gospel of Truth? What do you think separates those two?
When you say Four Heavenly Realms, that's got to have been translated some other way. I never heard of that before.
It's listed on Wikipedia, but it's supposedly a lost text from the New Testament of Apocrypha.
Okay, so how do we have it? Do we have it in manuscript form, or do we just have it by the church fathers critiquing it?
It looks like we have it just from the critiques is what it looks like.
Yeah, there's a couple others that we only have that way, like the Gospel of the Hebrews, the Gospel of the Ebionites. Actually, the Ebionites, I believe, were the earliest Christians. But that's totally beside the point of, you know, the origin of Christianity or the origins. Actually, I prefer in the plural. I prefer to say the origins because I don't believe Christianity had one single origin. I believe that the origins were manifold, and that's kind of what created the monster that we have now. But that's beside the point altogether. So, I've never...
Four heavenly realms.
No, I've never... It's got to be... Is that not in some kind of translation somewhere? Like it would be quad something or something like that?
Well, all I'm doing is going off of what they've listed there in the... on Wikipedia, so it of course has that margin of error, but
well, no, because like all right, I have this book right here. It's called the Gnostic Bible. It's by edited by William Barnstone, and what he did was he did a fucking funny thing. Was he translated? If I go into the table of contents, I've got something called the Reality of the Rulers. Now, in most cases, that's called the Hypothesis of the Archons. That's the name of that work. But you wouldn't know that because he translates the word hypothesis as reality and then rulers as archons. So if I didn't know that that was being translated that way and I was ignorant of that, I would think that, you know, that was a whole different thing. But no, that's the work that he was... And I just know that. I didn't even have to fucking read it, but... So I'm just wondering if this is something that I've seen before or haven't seen before. You said, like, because the four thing, that doesn't sound familiar to me at all.
Right. Well, it's listed along with 23 other lost gospels, like the Gospel of Bartholomew, the Gospel of the 70, the Gospel of Perfection, the Gospel of Martian. Now that I know that's right, the Gospel of Basilides, Gospel of
Facilities. Facilities.
Facilities. Well, I was close.
This is all funny to me because these are all going to be latex. Obviously, right. If you're putting Basilides at the name of a gospel, it's obviously late. I mean, just by any stretch.
Right on. Well, I'm not necessarily, I'm just interested. So you think that the difference is that they're not the early texts, they're later texts?
Oh, they definitely are later texts. The question is, well, every text that we have is relatively late other than Paul. That's really the problem to the origin of Christianity, to determining that, to figuring it out as a scholar. And I'm not no damn scholar, but I'm close. But the point is, though, that there's a real problem because everything we have is relatively late. Even an attestation, which means, like, you know, the fragments that we have. Like, there's Egerton fragments that are of the Gospel of John that are relatively early, but those don't prove that, you know, John was written before when scholars say it was. You know what I mean? It roughly comes from... about 20 years after that time. So that would fit with the model. The question is, you know, where did this whole thing come from, meaning this movement?
Right. Well, I mean, to me it's pretty obvious. This is the religion of Paul. This is not... It's not the religion of Jesus. But that's just my opinion.
I agree, and I somewhat disagree. I think that Paul had a big hand in shaping it, and I think that Paul changed it irrevocably, meaning that it's never been the same since. But I think there was something there prior to Paul, meaning there was a real vergence there prior to Paul that was going on, things that were going on. As a matter of fact, when you read Paul to me is the biggest tell that I can get on early Christianity. Why? Because he's the earliest. So, like, for example, I forget which epistle it was, but it was a genuine epistle of Paul in which he says that he was told by basically the people that were real apostles, because one of the biggest critiques of Paul was that he was not a real apostle because he had never seen Jesus. He had never, you know, been around him, nothing like that. But his brothers had. He was basically told, okay, go off in your own little corner and you can do your thing, but remember the poor. And poor is translated into Ebionim, which is the Ebionites, which if you look at that whole school of Christianity, then you'll begin to understand. And then when you know, cross-vector that with fucking, who's that dude, Josephus, and then when you cross-vector that with the fucking Dead Sea Scrolls, you'll start to get an idea of what really what was going on and what Jesus was really doing. And it had nothing to do with Christianity. It had absolutely nothing to do with Christianity, what Christianity eventually became. But that was the real beginning of it, if that makes any sense. So
yeah, it does, man. It makes very much sense in the, I guess, in the same light that a piece of canvas has to do with a painting. You know, that what Jesus was teaching was just this canvas, and somebody came along and covered it all up and filled it all in with nice, pretty details, and we forget to look at the simple construct of the canvas. So,
well, I wonder, one of the problems that I have when I have done my personal, you know, vectoring of this whole problem is, how did Christianity get spread the way it did? Now, I get that Paul did his missionary journeys and stuff like that, but it does seem to have spread too fast, too quickly, if that makes any sense, given everything that we know about this phenomenon. So,
well, I'm going to close all these other little windows here for a minute. I'm just going to kind of deal with this from my own perspective. Of course, I'm a big fan of the idea of memetics, and that ideas can spread really fast if they're introduced in the right way. Well, I'm kind of just thinking about how ancient Rome was back then, and how there was a big focus on bloodlust, so to speak. You know, they, as a matter of fact, in the very early days of Christianity, because of how expensive it was for them to retain gladiators and fight gladiators in their arena, what they did instead was take these newly confessed Christians and pull them out into the center of their big arenas and strap them up and beat them down. Well, these people, a lot of them, they wouldn't renounce Christianity for their own life. You know, that they did horrific things to these people, and they would still, they'd still swear by their faith and God all the way down to the end of that. And that kind of thing for a Roman civilian to witness would be something respectful. You know, and not just respectful, but respectable, rather.
Okay, let me cut in and just fucking, like, reality check it for a second. They couldn't have done that if there was no such thing as Christianity to begin with. So there had to be something there, at least a proto-something, that people were acknowledging or what have you. So you're talking about, like, the second layer. But go ahead, man.
Yeah, I am talking about the second layer because I think that the second layer was directly the proponent for propelling, you know, things along in terms of its growth. I mean, prior to that, I mean, it's not hard to see how, you know, a couple of dozen people could make national news, so to speak. You know, just by their missionary work and having to go through their little trials and tribulations. You know, if you get 20 people in a little city to feel bad for you because the Romans just imprisoned your ass for, you know, trying to incite riots and stuff, you know, everybody's going to be talking about, you know, what Big Brother just did that they don't like.
Well, actually, this is where I go kind of like off the page a little bit and say that personally, my personal analysis of this whole thing is that the movement, the Jesus movement, actually preexisted Jesus. It was actually in place before he came along. And
well,
so
I would kind of agree with that, because John the Baptist, was...
Exactly. Go ahead, man.
I was just going to say, John the Baptist was teaching this radical version of Judaism long before Jesus came along. It wasn't, in fact, until Jesus actually met with John the Baptist that he actually took a turn towards that and started working towards that himself.
Now we're 10 minutes out and we're finally getting into the good stuff. Actually, yeah, exactly. What I think was going on was that Jesus basically, he had five brothers, and I think his five brothers are crucial in understanding him and understanding the whole thing works. One of those brothers was named Judas. but, you know, the Gospels, because they want to make it 12 and because they want to distance themselves from that, they always say that that's a different Judas. I'm not entirely convinced of that. I think the Judas that betrayed him was his brother. But I'm not going to get into all that shit because we don't have the fucking time. What I think happened was that there were a lot of things going on, especially if you read Josephus, you'll get this. You had, the political vectors in Palestine at that time, which would have been the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But then you also had the Essenes, which were a movement that was going away from basically isolating oneself into the wilderness, what have you, communes, what have you. That would have been roughly John the Baptist or where he was coming from. I'm not saying he was an Essene or anything like that, but he would have been along those same lines. And then you had, on the other hand, you had the Zealots, and those were the guys that were like Simon Zelotes. Simon the Zealot is also counted amongst Jesus' 12. And then you have, of course, Judas Iscariot, who is, that would be of the Sicarii, who was a knife wielder, who was a guy along those same fucking lines. So then you have Jesus is kind of caught in the middle of all this bullshit. And what happens? He goes out to the wilderness to basically receive John's blessing in the baptism, because baptism back then wasn't just one thing you did once for all. It wasn't like you got baptized and now you're baptized. No, baptism was for not the remission of all sins for once and for all. It was for the remission of daily sins. It was something that they did. It was a communal thing. But there was a rift in that whole equation. And so it was like you had this guy who was one of five brothers, and a lot of those brothers were militant or doing things that were, like James, for example, declared basically a high priest in exile. If that makes any fucking sense, I'm not entirely sure it would. But after Jesus died, obviously James was the head of everything. But that's the head of everything that Jesus was actually doing, not necessarily the head of Christianity, because Paul was running around talking about other kind of shit. You know what I mean? And then somebody else got hold of that shit, and with Greek paradigms, they ended up making that into the, God-man myth. And... well, whatever.
Right,
we don't have at this point, I guess, enough time to talk about this, but at least I don't, but whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I can extend if you want me to, man. That's not a problem, but if not, I can just save it for another day. One thing I did want to kind of point out, though, was the... something that's downplayed in it all and kind of has always been a curious parallel for me, and that's the water worship that was involved in all of this. You know, you made mention of the baptism being something that was done more than just once. It was done frequently to wash your sins away. And I can think of a lot of the different parallels that Jesus was using were all water-based. You know, they were, like the Good Samaritan. Is it the Good Samaritan that goes to the well? I'm trying to remember.
Not the Good Samaritan. That's a different parallel. But there was a Samaritan, the Samaritan that went to the well. It wasn't the Good Samaritan. That was a different that was actually a what's the word I'm looking for here? Parable. But the Samaritan that went to the well, that wasn't a parable, that was actually a story.
Right, right. But there's the point of it being, you know, the feeding of the 5,000 or whatever it was, you know, that was done with fish. You know, there's just this whole water thing, you know, water into wine, and it's like this water worship, which at that point in time, it seems like just about every other culture on the planet was sun worshiping. So,
well, you have to understand why. Is that if you really go back to the ancient Canaanite, triple, which they had a triple, not unlike we have a triple. Yeah, I'll say we. I mean, I don't mean we in any fucking stretch of the imagination. What I mean is that, like, if you look at the way that, like, for example, the Greeks had a triple. They had a triple, like, for example, you had Zeus, and you had Pluto, or Hades, whatever his name was. I'm mixing up the Greek and the fucking Roman, whatever. And then you have Poseidon. They had the same thing. Meaning the Canaanites did. And if you want to really go to where the Hebrews got their culture from, they got it from the Canaanites, because the Canaanites were the original Hebrews. So they gave some of that to them. And then also, for example, the exile gave them some other things. Like, he gave them angels, for example. Angels didn't come along until they were exiled, the Babylonian exile. So they got a lot of shit from Babylon. And they got fucking Adam and Eve and Eden from Babylon. But that's beside the point. The idea, though, is that there's this triple. And in the Canaanite triple, it's basically heaven, water, and death. And those are the three triples. You would have heaven would be El, and then water would be Yam, or Yah, which ended up becoming Yahweh, which ended up becoming God of the Old Testament, which will make sense in a second. And then, of course, you had Mat, which was death. And that guy ended up getting with the eraser and erased out of the whole equation. But that's really where it all came from. So you can see, if you read through Job, especially in the Psalms, Job and the Psalms tell a lot of this story where you'll see water prefigures a whole fucking lot, even in fucking Genesis, where you have the waters above the firmament, the waters below the firmament, and God separated the waters. Why was that his first act? Why was God's first act to separate waters? Okay? You know, it all makes sense when you get it all, but nobody gets it all. Even I don't get it all. But I'm just saying, you got to get some of it and get some of it, so...
Right on. Right on. Well, we got about 2 minutes left, dude. I don't think we're hard-pressed to fill with any other content. Thanks for coming on. This has actually been very enlightening to me.
Well, no, I mean, this was something that was cool. I mean, I guess we probably put it at early time, and people will come back to it later, and this will be your highest-rated show. No, I'm just kidding.
To me,
it doesn't matter either way. I mean... The real important thing, though, is that, you know, people would possibly understand or come to try to understand these whole things, all these vectors. There's so many vectors. It's so, to me, it's like, I'm the kind of guy, I just like a puzzle to solve. And to me, the origin of Christianity is a puzzle to solve. And it's one of the funnest ones for me, because there's so many loose pieces, and I just love it so much for that reason. You know what I mean? It's not because I'm in love with Jesus or something like that, but I just really like that puzzle.
Right on, man. And I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with knowing and understanding other people's beliefs, even if you don't hold them yourselves. I think that the sooner we solve all of these mysteries for ourselves, the sooner we can move on to something that's, I don't know, more productive for us as a species. Or at least us.
Yeah, well, that's a whole different question, right?
That's it. But I'm not going to say we need to go into that. I mean, maybe if people want to hear part two of this, we'll do it in the future. But I thought it was definitely something worthy of bringing up. And
I did too. You booked it too early, and well, you did that for me, and that's all good. But at the same time, nobody else is awake yet, and they'll all come back to it, and they'll be like, "Damn, why did I miss out on this show? This sucks. I wanted to call in." Have you ever seen a BTR where you were like, you saw the show and you were like, "Damn, I wish I could have called into that fucking show."
Yeah,
I know I have, but hey, whatever.
Yeah, man, it is what it is, dude, and we did just fine. An hour without any fucking stuttering or, well, mispronunciations on my part, but.
So good. I went to Catholic school. Fuck it. They'll fuck around with that shit. I can pronounce Irenaeus. It doesn't mean I understand anything.
Right on, man. That's it. I'm going to go ahead and roll the outro, dude, and I'll talk to you sometime this next week.
All right, dude.
Thank you for listening to The Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily represent the opinions held by TC, Zach, Jason, Matt, or any other institution represented by them. If you have been offended by the production of this show, we are sorry, but this is the old expression goes. Tough luck. Special thanks to Zadaraki Garoma for his contribution to this outro. The Ooze is a Creative Oddity Studios product and is presented by Titanic International Network as its official Blog Talk radio show. Why waste your time with those other guys?